Last week, we went through a part of the prologue. This particular lesson will complete what we left off unfinished, and I will also add in certain details that I had deliberately omitted last week. You will gather from this that we are proceeding at what might be called a leisurely pace. Therefore, if the Lord tarries, and if I remain sound in mind and body, we should be done with the study of Job in about 5 years' time. Of course, if my mind breaks down before then, hopefully Joshua Young can take over. Today we focus on the character of Job. There will not be time, I think, to go into the heavenly court, which is part of the prologue, part of the prose introduction, but we certainly want to focus on Job under various headings. We covered Job in his private life. And if I had to summarize the secret of his strength and stability, and even of his success in everything that he did, I would go back to the words that he himself uttered in chapter 23, verse 12. He said very clearly, "Neither have I gone back from the commandment of his," that is God's lips. "I have esteemed the words of God's mouth more than my necessary food." And this is really the key to the success of his entire life. What he was in private, in his relationship with God, determine what he was throughout the whole course of his life. For Job, as we saw last week, during the quiet time was not just a matter of daily necessity or of ritual, but it was something that he took great delight in, which means, in effect, that every opportunity he had throughout the day, he would spend time with God. And it is this intimacy with God on a daily or hourly basis that gave him the kind of inner peace and serenity, that gave him the strength and stability, the wisdom and the discernment to cope with all the vicissitudes of life. His fellowship with Jehovah, in other words, was the secret of his success at everything that he did. So today we look at more details at the subject of Job in his family life. I draw your attention to verses 4 and 5 of chapter 1. "And his sons went and feasted in their houses, every one his day, and sent and called for their three sisters to eat and drink with them." By the way, the seven brothers in the family, the number seven, is said to be the size of the ideal family. In our context, the size of the ideal family would be two. Vast difference. But in the culture of the ancient Near East, the size of the ideal family would be seven. How do we know that? If you care to jump forward to 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 5, what do we read there? "The barren hath borne seven." So this gives us a clue, 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 5, that having seven was a blessing in itself, an ideal family. Well, here we find the Gentile Job blessed even more abundantly than this, because not only did he have the ideal number of 7 children, he was particularly blessed with 3 additional children, daughters. And we do know even today that daughters bring a particular blessing to the family, sometimes perhaps even more than sons. So the Gentile Job was abundantly blessed by God even in his family life, for he had more than the ideal number of 7. And now chapter 1 verse 5, "And it was so when the days of their feasting were gone about, concluded, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For," Job said, "it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. The first thing that strikes us in these 2 verses is the unity of this large family. In our time, it is not at all uncommon for siblings to sue each other in court, usually over matters of inheritance. But this was certainly not so with Job's 7 sons and 3 daughters. Why is that so? It is clear from the text that Job exercised the most solicitous care over all his children, and that from birth. And this bore fruit in the strength of the bond between the siblings and between the children and their parents. That is one major reason that contributed to the strength and stability of this large family. There's one other factor which contributed to the unity and harmony of this family. And to understand or to appreciate this factor, we have to realize that Job lived in the patriarchal age, either a contemporary of Abraham or even predating Abraham. If you like to put a date to it, I would suggest around 2000 BC, maybe even earlier. Now you have to recall what you may have learned or studied earlier. What was the norm during the patriarchal age? What was the norm for marriage? We know, for example, that Noah was married to one woman, and as far as we can tell, for the entire duration of his life. But when we come to Abraham, we find that this is not so. Abraham had more than one wife. So what was the norm, what was the common practice in relation to marriage during the patriarchal age? Was it monogamy or polygamy? It is important to realize which of the two it was. The norm was actually not monogamy, it was polygamy. In the light of this practice in ancient times, it is all the more remarkable that we find this Gentile, Job, married to one woman and to one woman only. Having said that, we need to justify it, and the justification comes from the text as well as from reasonable inferences that we can draw from the text. In the first place, if you look at the wording in the text, in the whole of the chapter, there can be no doubting the fact that all these 7 sons and 3 daughters had the same biological mother. And even after the restoration of Job, towards the end of the book, we find that the Lord gave him another set of 7 sons and 3 daughters. But notice this, There is no mention throughout the book, absolutely no mention of the death of the first wife or of Job's attempt to marry a second. So although it is not explicitly stated Job had only one wife in the sacred text, here is where we can draw a reasonable inference from the entire context of the book. He was married legally to one woman before his troubles. He remained married to her all the way to the end, even after his fortunes were reversed. The importance of monogamous marriage in cementing the unity of the family and enhancing the family harmony should not be underestimated, because in every case of polygamous marriage that we find recorded in the Bible, with or without concubinage, an added complication, every example of polygamous marriage that is recorded in the Bible resulted or ensued in intense sibling rivalry, leading often to antagonism and sometimes murder. It was not so with Job's 7 sons and 3 daughters. They were fully grown, but they remained as close and united as when they were little children. You may like to note that the patriarchs who descended initially from the line of Seth, Noah was one example, adhered to monogamy, whereas those who descended from the reprobate line of Cain, the Cainites, took 2 or more wives. And in that respect, this character by the name of Lamech, I don't think I've written his name here, Lamech had the distinction of being the world's first polygamist. He was the first one that we find a record of that tells us that he married 2 wives. Genesis chapter 4 verse 19, and Lamech took unto him 2 wives. The name of the one was Adah, and the name of the other Zillah. Lamech was in the 6th generation from Adam, in the Cainite line, the reprobate line. And already in that line, 6 generations after Adam, we find the stirrings of carnality and worldliness, a defiance of God, and a determination to establish a worldly paradise for themselves and their descendants. The very names of Lamech's wives betray this tendency to carnality and worldliness. The name of the first wife, Adah, means ornament. Zillah signifies shade or tinkling. So although it may sound harsh, there is some basis for saying that even the choice of names betrays the attitude of the people concerned, of the family concerned, of the society concerned. They were carnal and worldly. It is just like parents today, unsaved parents, naming their children after pop stars. The same concept here. The brothers, now back to the brothers. They were, of course, adults at this point in time. They appear to have lived in separate houses, but they held regular family get-togethers. The problem here is this: how often or when were these family get-togethers held? The text merely tells us, in regard to these family feasts, each one his day. So now we have to make a little effort to identify what this phrase his day means? Some commentators argue that it means the birthday of that brother in question. It sounds reasonable, but consider what are the implications of this. Seven brothers, if these family get together, these family feasts were tied to the birthdays of the brothers, and if there were seven of them, it would mean that in the course of the year there were only seven feasts. What about the three daughters? Does it mean that their birthdays were not celebrated? It seems rather odd, given the unity and harmony of that family, that only the brothers' birthdays would be celebrated and the sisters' birthdays would be conveniently ignored. For this reason, I incline to the view that the phrase his day does not refer to the birthday of that particular brother, but rather it refers to the day of the week. So in other words, each day of the week there was a family reunion, a dinner perhaps, and when the cycle of seven was completed the following Monday, speaking in modern terms, the cycle went on. So although the seven brothers lived apart from each other, this daily get-together over a family meal was an important practical step in cementing family unity. We can learn from this, particularly parents with grown-up children. Make them come together for a family meal as often as possible, because there's enough practical evidence to show that this is a very powerful means of cementing family unity and harmony. And this was so in the case of Job. Let us pause here for a moment and digress to do a little snooping. Snooping of the gossipy kind. Seven brothers, three sisters. Were the sisters married? Reading the text, you have to do a little detective work and figure out whether they were married. And whichever, either they were or they weren't, whichever position you take, be prepared to justify it. Were the three sisters married? Consider this. When the brothers held their weekly round of feasting, we are told in the text that they invited their three sisters, correct? No mention made of their spouses. How would you feel if you are invited to a wedding dinner and your spouse is conveniently left out? You're not going to feel very happy about it, because it is understood that the man and his wife are really one unit. That being the case, we can infer from this situation that the three sisters were unmarried. What about the brothers now? Were the brothers married? Our natural tendency is to say they must have been, because they lived in separate houses. So all right, if the three sisters were unmarried, seeing that the text says that only they were invited for the family feast, we can accept that they were unmarried. What about the boys? They were full-grown adults, each lived in his own house. Were the brothers married? Again, we don't speculate. We read the text and try to draw necessary inferences which can be supported by the text again. Consider the manner in which the death of the children was reported to Job by the sole survivor of that disaster. You remember, the sole surviving servant came up to Job and told him, and I am paraphrasing here, all your 10 children were killed when the tornado or whatever freak wind it was brought down the roof of the house. In the death of the children and of the entire retinue of servants who lived in the eldest brother's house, there is no record of the brother's wives also having died. If the brothers were married and they held this feast each day of the week, don't you find it exceedingly odd that the brothers' wives are not participating in the family dinner? We are told by the testimony of the sole surviving servant that in the tragedy of death that followed, only the 10 children and the servants died. No mention of the brothers' wives. So from this we infer that the 7 boys were themselves unmarried. That raises another question of human interest. If they were not married, why were they living in their own homes? As far as the girls are concerned, in the culture of that time, there is no problem with this. So long as they were unmarried, they had to live in the parental home. No question about that. But if the boys were unmarried, isn't it a little unusual or unconventional for them to live apart in separate homes? Again, going by the scriptural record, this was not unconventional. For example, if you care to look at 2 Samuel chapter 13 verse 7, 2 Samuel 13 verse 7, and also again 2 Samuel chapter 14 verse 28, you will read the following. Then David sent home to Tamar, saying, "Go to thy brother," actually stepbrother, "go to thy brother Amnon's house," and note please that Amnon at that point in time was unmarried, yet living in his own house. "Go to thy brother Amnon's house and dress him meat." And then chapter 14 verse 28, "Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem and saw not the king's face." This could only be the case if Absalom lived in his own house. So it was not unconventional for the sons, the adult sons, to live apart. I mean to live in their own homes. But in Job's case, the physical separation did not affect the family unity. There may have been practical reasons why the sons had to live separate lives. They were adults. They probably had their own flocks of sheep and cattle. They were probably engaged in running their own business. Therefore, it made practical sense for them to live in their own house and not, so to speak, clutter up the family home with Job and the 3 sisters. So this was not an unusual or unconventional arrangement. We are still looking at Job in relation to his family, and we need to pay close attention now to the way in which he cared for his children. Job chapter 1 verse 5, "And it was so when the days of their feasting were gone about," that is concluded, "that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For," Job said, "it may be," there is a possibility, "that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. It's very important to note that. We see Job in these activities functioning as a priest for the immediate family and for his household, and this at an age when there was no established priesthood serving Jehovah, and Job and his family were in any case outside of the covenant line. So being Gentiles, outside of the covenant line, no priesthood, serving the one living and true God, and yet Job knew this one living and true God on a personal, intimate level, and he fulfilled what was required to sanctify his children. He took his duties as a priest of the family very seriously, because if you note how verse 5 ends, it ends in this way: thus did Job continually. It was not an ad hoc thing. As and when he remembered, he practiced it. It was a regular practice for him. Was Job opposed to their feasting? Obviously not. But his concern was something more significant than that. His concern was that in the course of their feast festivities, they may have, and this is a confusing part, they may have blessed God in their hearts. Yes, indeed, the Hebrew word that is used is barak, which almost always is used of blessing, not cursing. So if it was barak in the sense of blessing, why was Job concerned that they might have cursed God? There are two factors to be noted. Firstly, consider how we today take leave of someone's company or say farewell to a person. We don't say welcome when we are leaving that person and going away. Do we not say goodbye? What does that word goodbye mean? It is actually a contraction of a phrase. It's a contraction of the phrase, God be with you. Isn't that a form of blessing? We are taking our leave of that person, going away from that person. And when we say goodbye, we are actually giving a blessing, God be with you. So if that is the case, the rendition in the Authorized Version where it is stated that his sons may have blessed God in their heart, may have cursed God in their hearts, is to be understood in this sense, that in the course of their feasting, they may have, so to speak, bid farewell to God internally. And this illustrates Job's concern. His concern was that there are two types of sins. I am not here proposing the Roman Catholic categorization of sins, but clearly there are two categories of sins. There are sins of the flesh, drunkenness, overeating, or gluttony. There are also sins of the heart, sins of the attitude. And the latter category of sins is far more serious in terms of the consequences than the sins of the flesh. So Job's concern was perfectly understandable. He was more concerned with the attitude of his children toward God, particularly during their time of feasting and enjoyment. He was concerned that they might have said or done things which would be equivalent to saying farewell to God in their heart. The second factor, and this is related to the first, is a very thorny one. They feasted every day of the week. But we read from the text that these feasts involved the partaking of wine. Now, the Hebrew word for wine that is used in this particular context is yayin, which means fermented wine, drink that is bubbling, effervescing, which means fermented. So is this a justification for us to include wine in our family feast? Is this a justification for women during pregnancy to take Yomeshu on the grounds that it is good for me? We need to be very careful here. We do not know how strong was this fermented wine, but definitely it was intoxicating. So Job's concern was this. It is easy enough for human beings with a sin nature in them to forget God as and when it is things are going well with them. How much more so, how much easier will it be when you are involved in merrymaking, where the tongue is loosened by alcohol and the constraints of conscience are also subdued by the same agent, Yayin. Therefore, Job's concerns in this regard are fully understandable. And as a wise and caring father, he always had a damage control plan. And his damage control plan moved him to take proactive measures. And what did he do? Very simple and very direct. After each round of feasting was concluded, he would summon all his children to come to him for a time, not of dressing down, but a time of reflection and repentance. It was a very caring, a very pastor-like attitude. You have engaged in your feasting, it's understandable, you keep your unity and affection for one another. But in the course of your feasting, did you last night say or do anything that would be dishonoring to God? Children, please review this. So he's calling them together after each round, every single round of feasting was for a time of reflection and repentance. The way he approached it was not to force his children, they were anyway adults, not to bear down on them, not to point an accusing finger, but to guide them as a wise father would, guide them to see for themselves whether they would have sinned against God in their hearts the night before during their feasting. Having gone through this time of family reflection and repentance, he would then rise up early the following morning to offer burnt offerings voluntarily according to the total number of his children. Be careful here, because some commentators put forward the view that Job offered these burnt offerings only for the 7 sons. The 3 daughters did not matter. Personally, I find this ridiculous, because if you look at verse 5 again, you will see that Job offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. The Hebrew word for all there is kol, K-O-L-O with an accent mark on it. And kol in Hebrew means each and every single one. Therefore, the text itself tells us that he offered burnt offerings for all 10 children and not just for the 7 sons. What is this burnt offering? What does it signify? The Hebrew word for burnt offering here is olah, and it refers to the smoke of the offering ascending upwards to heaven. It symbolized, therefore, the total dedication or consecration of one's life to God. Bear in mind the remarkable nature of this sacrifice. Not only was Job an Edomite, not only was he outside of the covenant line, not only was it the case that he lived at a time long, long before the Mosaic law was given, and yet in his religious practices, he is proving to be a more true and obedient servant of Jehovah than many of the people of Israel themselves. Truly, it is by the grace of God. Under Mosaic law, which of course was promulgated long after Job, and you can read this in Leviticus chapter 1 and chapter 4, under Mosaic law, the burnt offering was always voluntary. It was for sin in general, and it symbolized an act of rededication or reconsecration. On the other hand, the sin offering was not voluntary. It was mandatory. It had to be done for everyone from the high priest down to the humblest person. So in the case of Job, he offered up a burnt offering signifying his rededicating his 10 children to the Lord. Do you not find it surprising that 10 fully grown adult children, upon being summoned by their father, would obediently come to dad's house, sit together with him, and hear him go through or leading them through a process of self-examination? Our children today inclined to behave the same way. It is truly a rare parent who has not been rebutted with this remark, "Come on, Dad, I'm 20 something, I know what I'm doing." It is sometimes for us parents in this day and age so hard to get our adult children to come together for family worship. In Job's case, because of the care and attention he devoted to their childhood years, when they were adults, they remained true to his standards. I'm reminded of that teaching in Proverbs, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." Job did not know about Proverbs because that came centuries after him. But he understood instinctively the value of training up his children from the cradle right through to adulthood. If you haven't trained up your child by the time he is 7 or 8, you have effectively lost the window of opportunity to bring your child to God. Not that it's impossible to do so, it's in God's hands, but it is an enormous struggle, an uphill struggle after that. The first 6 to 7 years are your God-given opportunity as parents to nurture in them the fear and reverence for God. When all his children were killed in one fell swoop by the hand of Satan, Job reacted with deep grief. To be expected, he rent his mantle, shaved his head, and then what did he do? Did he curse God for this disaster? We read that apart from going through the external motions of showing grief, he worshipped God. Meaning to say, he expressed heartfelt gratitude to God for having lent, not given, lent those 10 children to him. This is because he correctly regarded the 10 children not as his, but rather as belonging to Jehovah right from the start, and that God had merely entrusted these 10 children to him and to his wife, entrusted to them, to Job and his wife, with the mission of nurturing them in the fear and admonition of the Lord. This was the correct perspective of our children. Our children are not ours, though we often speak of it for convenience as my son, my daughter. But in effect, they are lent to him by God. an interesting observation when we are really jumping forward now to the end of the book. He had thousands of sheep, oxen, she-asses, and from memory I recall 3,000 camels. He lost them all. When at the end of the book, the Lord restored Job's material prosperity, that restoration took a very unusual form. He was given double of whatever he lost. If he had 3,000 camels, he now was given 6,000. As far as his flocks were concerned, he was given double what he had before. But what about the replacement children? If he had 7 sons before, he now is given 7 new sons. Where he had 3 daughters before, he is now given 3 new daughters. So it is really a 1-for-1 replacement. We are inclined to wonder why. When it comes to cattle, oxen, sheep and camels, why did the Lord give him double what he had before? But when it came to the children, why was he not given 14 sons and 6 daughters? I'd like to suggest a reason for this. Yes, he lost his original cohort of children, 7 sons, 3 daughters. But did he really lose them? Job, as a believer, knew that they were not lost to him forever. He would one day meet them in the presence of Jehovah. Therefore, the 7 plus 3 new children that he is given, 7 sons and 3 daughters, when they all meet together in heaven, he would have 14 sons and 6 daughters. So for this reason, I believe the numbers of sons and daughters was not doubled, but the numbers of sheep, camels, oxen, and she-asses was doubled. Because animals have no souls and there's no question of salvation for them, no question of a pet's heaven and a pet's hell for them either. So Job's reaction to the loss of his children showed that he was actually well aware of life after death and well aware of the fact that the soul, when it dies, is either with God or is in a place of condemnation. We cannot leave the topic of Job's family life without commenting on his relationship with his wife. I ask you to jump forward to chapter 2 and look at verses 9 and 10. Job chapter 2 verses 9 and 10. Then said his wife unto him, "Dost thou still retain thine integrity? Curse God and die." But he said unto her, "Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil?" In all this did not Job sin with his mouth. I have never given birth to children, and it is highly improbable I ever will. But I can at least appreciate this much. The 9 months of continual privations carrying a child, the agony of childbirth, the hard and unremitting labor of bringing up children from the cradle to adulthood would make the loss of any one of those children when grown a singularly painful blow for the mother. In Mrs. Job's case, she lost not one, not two, but all 10. And she lost them in a sequence like dominoes, which gave her no opportunity to recover. If we face disaster after disaster, or trouble after trouble, and they all come together, if your credit card bills come together, and on the same day you receive a traffic summons offering to compound your fine for $1,000, then your bank calls you up and tells you that your investment account needs to be topped up, you are liable to feel completely lost, because all these troubles have come together in one go. If they had come singly or in isolation, we can generally cope with them one by one. In Mrs. Job's case, please appreciate, from a mother's perspective, it is an unbearable loss to lose one child. She lost all 10, and she lost them in one go, no chance for her to recover from the shock. Additional point to note, at this particular point in time, at this low ebb of their family life, Job had been stricken by Satan on a personal level. He was stricken with boils all over from head to foot, and therefore he was treated like a leper, an outcast, sitting outside the city gates. Being an outcast meant that for Mrs. Job now, there is no security whatsoever. Given all these factors, it is not surprising that she broke down the way she did. I would suggest that we refrain from taking an uncharitable view of her, but look at her from the human perspective. Would you mothers have reacted differently? I very much doubt that any one of us would have reacted differently from Mrs. Job. If you look at the words that Job used in speaking to her, they indicate that Job understood this aspect of his wife's outburst. Notice how he spoke to her. He said unto her, "Thou speakest as one of the foolish women." The word foolish there in the Hebrew is Nabal. And those of you who have done 1st and 2nd Samuel will recall a character called Nabal, which means worthless, empty. So he is not saying that you are an empty-headed woman talking like this. He is saying to his wife, you are speaking as if you are one of them. This indicates that Job understood that she was not in her normal frame of mind, and that therefore she needed to be gently guided back to a position of stability. And this is what he did in the follow-up in verse 10. Shall we, not you, first person plural, shall we, that is you and I, not receive good at the hand of God, and shall we, you and I, not receive evil? He's putting himself alongside her. And this was his attempt to stabilize her in the face of these awful calamities, by reminding her that, taken in the proper perspective, all things work together for good to them that love God. In doing so, in handling his wife in this gentle way, guiding her back to a level of stability, he was in fact honoring his marriage covenant to stick with her for better or for worse. And his devotion to his wife is further borne out by his declaration in chapter 31, verse 1, "I made a covenant with mine eyes, why then should I think upon a maid?" So which put this all together, and it reinforces the idea that he was a one-woman man from the time he married till death parted them both. Unlike the patriarchs of his age, He believed in one man, one woman for life. So much for Job and his family life. We need to consider him in the context of his society. And the relevant chapters are chapters 29 and 31. I will not read these chapters as time does not permit. But what we learn from these two chapters, 29 and 31, is that he was not only a successful businessman, he was highly actively involved in the affairs of state. He was, in fact, a leader in society, a judge, and most highly regarded indeed. The question that has troubled many commentators is this: his involvement in city life, as seen in chapters 29 and 31, means that he was at the very bottom a city dweller, an urbanite. And yet we read of his vast flocks of sheep, camel, oxen, she asses. So vast were they that they needed huge and extensive pastoral lands to support them. How could a man be a city dweller and also be so heavily engaged in a pastoral lifestyle, a rustic, a country lifestyle? Based on that, these commentators have suggested that there were two different authors to the book of Job. However, recent sociological studies of the ancient Near East have clearly demonstrated that the society of that day and age could accommodate these two levels of living, the rustic or the pastoral lifestyle with the urban or city lifestyle. And in fact, sociologists who have made a specialty of studying conditions in the ancient Near East have coined a special term to describe such societies. And that term, if you can read it, is dimorphic. Dimorphism comes from biology, but in this context, in the context of sociology, it refers to a society which is both urban and also accommodates a pastoral lifestyle. So there was no contradiction in Job leading the two modes of living. I mentioned chapters 29 and 31. Chapter 31, we will learn how Job dealt with his servants, how he dealt with the poor and downtrodden of society, and how he dealt with strangers. Clearly, Job saw all men as sinners before his supreme creator and judge. And as we have seen thus far, his entire conduct and lifestyle in private as well as in public reminds us of what Paul wrote centuries later. I draw your attention to Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. Romans 2, 14 and 15. For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these, having not the law, are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another. This then is the picture presented to us of a good man in the land of Uz, whose name was Job. Next week, we shall venture upon a very exciting section of the prologue, the heavenly court.